You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Sunday right here on KTP. And as you all know, on Perspectives, we feature the book club. And today we're featuring Blanche Wieson-Cook, and she is the author of the final book, trilogy on Eleanor Roosevelt. She is also an award-winning author, and she has some other distinguished writings. There's The Declassified Eisenhower, The Crystal Eastman on Women and the Revolution, and of course, Eleanor Roosevelt, Volume 1, was a winner of the LA Times Book Prize, and both books were New York Times bestsellers, and I expect this one to be no different. Anyway, she is a distinguished professor of history at John Jay College and Graduate Center, City University of New York. So Blanche, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, we were discussing briefly before the program started a little bit about Eleanor Roosevelt, and I guess it was last year when PBS had that show on the Roosevelts, and it gave us a little bit more insight on Eleanor Roosevelt, but you've been doing that, as I mentioned, more because this is the third volume.
This is the third volume, The War Years and After.
So it's unusual to have three-volume biographies of women. I think three-volume biographies of people in general are unusual unless you're talking about like Shelby Foote's Civil War or something else like that. But you did a three-volume biography on Eleanor Roosevelt, and people may be wondering, well, how long did you take? And you took, what, like 25 years or something like that to do your research?
Yeah, I started in 1982, and it just grew and grew and got better and better. Because Eleanor Roosevelt never stopped growing and changing, and she said she lived her life as an adventurer, and her life is an adventure. She would plunge into depression on occasion, but the more she worked, the better she felt. And she left us an incredible record with letters, correspondence. She wrote to so many people. And then she wrote so many columns. She wrote a daily column from 1936 until practically the month she died in 1962. And then she wrote countless articles and about 20 books. And it's really, as Joe Lash, her great friend and biographer, said, Eleanor Roosevelt is infinite.
We're visiting with Blanche Wieson-Cook, and she is the author of the New York Times bestselling trilogy, Eleanor Roosevelt. And this final book is Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962. And Blanche, perhaps a lot of people remember her most for The War Years and After, and particularly during the war years, because she was an incredible first lady and very influential in working sometimes with and sometimes against Franklin Roosevelt, because she had some very different ideas from her husband, but at the same time, he always listened to her.
He did always listen to her, but he didn't always follow her advice, especially when it came to race and rescue. And I think what Eleanor Roosevelt is really important as we face the future at this moment for is, despite a Dixiecrat-dominated Congress that didn't want to integrate anything, Eleanor Roosevelt went around the country and around the world talking about and acting upon her vision for racial justice. And so she's, you know, in part responsible for the Tuskegee Airmen getting to fly those great black flyers, the Red Tails, who did so much incredible work during the war. And Eleanor Roosevelt was behind them every step of the way. She encouraged black women to become officers, and she was amazing. And then she wanted to see integrated bases, which did not happen, so that we don't have integration in the military until really Eisenhower. But Eleanor Roosevelt's vision was so important in the first steps that were taken for racial justice.
And as you mentioned racial justice, one of the things that we're seeing now is, of course, the battle over immigration and the Syrian refugees. And as you mentioned, she talked to FDR, and very few people know about this, the fact that while they were entertaining King George and Queen Elizabeth, there was an ocean liner with refugees.
Right. The SS St. Louis sent back to Europe, 900 people sent back to Europe. No port of entry, no haven granted. And the headlines for that week were shared by the King and Queen's visit and the great tragedy of the refugees who are not let in. And Eleanor Roosevelt was really appalled. that there was no port of entry, and she vowed that she would not let that happen again. The next ship that was stranded in Virginia was a ship called the Kwanza, Q-U-A-N-Z-A. And Eleanor Roosevelt insisted that the 80 people on board who were going to be sent back to Europe were her guests, be admitted as her guests. But there was a man named Breckinridge Long, who, one of the mysteries of the book is FDR did not fire Breckinridge Long, who was a man who insisted there not be haven, there not be refugees, not be allowed into this country. And FDR promoted Breckinridge Long. They were Groton classmates and Harvard classmates and friends for a very long time. And he kept giving him all this power in the State Department. And Eleanor Roosevelt was astonished. She said things like, "Franklin, you know he's a fascist." And Franklin said, "Well, don't use that word." But he never fired Breckinridge Long, and there's no haven for refugees in the United States until 1944, which is a very big part of the story, when Henry Morgenthau and the Treasury Department decides it's urgent, it's time to create a War Refugee Board and ignore the State Department. But it's too little, too late. It's a great tragedy. And you see the sort of undercover efforts of Eleanor Roosevelt and her friends to provide some kind of rescue. I spend time on the Varian Fry Rescue Committee, which is stopped by the State Department, as well as the fascists in France, but it's really the State Department.
Let's talk a little bit about, going back a bit, about her growing up. And a lot of people, some people say, well, you know, they married their cousins, but they were distant cousins. But the fact that Eleanor had some ties to Teddy Roosevelt, because it was Teddy's brother who was her father. Let's talk a little bit about her parents. First, let's talk about her mother.
Well, I think it's really important to put this in context of how did Eleanor get this way? How did she get to be so committed to people in want, in need, in trouble? And it has everything to do with her father, who she loved. Her mother was very cold and mean to her, but her father really loved her. Her father, however, was an alcoholic, and he died at the age of 34. And we really need to pause to, you know, hey, how much do you have to drink to die at the age of 34?
Yes.
And Eleanor Roosevelt's commitment to people in want, in need, in trouble, her identification with everybody. She said government exists for only one purpose, to make life better for all people, especially people in want, in need, in trouble. And it's really about her family. Her mother essentially turned her face to the wall and died when Eleanor was 8. Her father dies when she's 10. And her life is saved, really, and inspired when she goes away to school in England, to the Allenswood School, where she is tutored and inspired by Marie Souvestre. But it's her childhood of sadness and loss that connects her and is her lifelong love affair, really, with the people. Her great friend, Lady Stella Redding, said, "Eleanor's first love are the people." And that has everything to do with wanting things to be better for people in want, in need, in trouble, just like her own family.
In this age of the media and advertising and beauty, people want to know, you know, everybody looks so attractive and they want to be on that television, etc. Her mother, Anne Hall, did not presume herself to be attractive, and Eleanor herself was a beautiful young lady. But she was, I don't remember if it was her grandmother or her mother who told her that she looked like a granny.
Yeah, her mother. Her mother was very mean to her. And she said, you know, "Come in here, little granny." And she made Eleanor feel miserable. So Eleanor always had a very shy self-presentation. However, she also had courage. And she said things like, "Courage can be as contagious as fear." She said she lived her life as an adventurer, and despite how she was treated as a child by her cold mother, she was inspired by the love of her father and the support of her great mentor. And then everywhere Eleanor Roosevelt went, she connected to people. She identified with people, connected with people. And she always had just two questions. She never told them what she thought. She said, "Tell me, what do you want? What do you need?" And it was this ability to transcend the limitations of how she felt about herself, you know, how she looked. And she took voice lessons to get her voice down when she became the first lady of radio so she wouldn't be so high-pitched. You know, I mean, she cared about how she looked. And she dressed beautifully, and she dressed comfortably. And she started every day with exercise and rode her horse almost every day until a certain age, when I think it's wise to stop riding horses. And she was surrounded by people who supported her and loved her. She had her great support network and her closest friends.
Blanche, tell us about her relationship with her Uncle Teddy.
With her Uncle Teddy?
Yes.
Well, Alice, her cousin, was always very jealous of Eleanor Roosevelt because she felt that her father, T.R., loved Eleanor best. And he did. He thought that she was a brilliant young child, and he was very warm and supportive of her.
And Alice, I guess, is a story for another book.
That's
because
another
she was very
book,
different.
There are other books on Alice Roosevelt Longworth, and there's a new book called The Hissing Cousins, which is a wonderful book that really goes into their both enmity and mutual support. They come to each other with love when each are in crisis over time.
We are visiting with New York Times bestselling author Blanche Wieslyn Cook. The latest book in the trilogy is Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962. You mentioned earlier about how she took voice lessons for when she was on the radio. And for people who lived in that era, her voice on the radio was just as familiar as FDR's Fireside Chats.
Absolutely. She had radio programs continually. She had a daily column from 1936 to the end of her life. And she wrote dozens and dozens, scores of articles every year.
Tell me about, because as you mentioned, she did have a syndicated newspaper column. I think it was called My Day, yes. And one of the things that came out from reading your book is also that in December of 1944, First Lady E.R., as you referred to her, she was the first journalist to discuss Auschwitz.
She was. The news of Auschwitz was leaking. People weren't paying attention to the concentration camps. And Eleanor Roosevelt wrote the first article about Auschwitz in 1944. Such a hideous story. And again, like the question of why so few havens, the question of why didn't they bomb this camp, will always be a mystery for all of us.
And as you mentioned earlier, she was also very involved in not just the refugees and the Jewish refugees, the children, but she was very involved also in civil rights. And she encouraged, as you mentioned earlier, black women, African-American women, and artists. And one of those was Marian Anderson in the concert at the Lincoln Memorial. Tell us about that.
Well, the DAR refused its constitutional hall for Marian Anderson, who was this world-famous diva, to perform. And Eleanor Roosevelt and Harold Ickes said, okay, perform at the Lincoln Memorial. And 75,000 people came to her Easter concert at the Lincoln Memorial. And it really highlighted, as Icky said when he wrote about it, was the happiest day of his life, and he introduced her, genius has no collar bar. It's like what we have to remember. Genius has no collar line. The heart is on the left. Eleanor Roosevelt said, we will have peace. We will not have peace until we have education for all, housing for all, jobs for all. And she called for free public higher education, free for all, in 1943. And here we are, public schools closing all over the country, with sports and music programs ending all over the country. And Eleanor Roosevelt said, music is the universal language, and sports is a requirement for life. And the happiest day of her life, she wrote at the age of 76, was the day she made the first team at field hockey at the Allenswood School. So sports and music war for Eleanor Roosevelt, What Unites Us. She supported the youth orchestra, which was integrated. She supported every, in 1934, Eleanor Roosevelt, this is in volume two, but it also is in volume three. In 1934, the educators of America condemned segregation. And Eleanor Roosevelt strode upon the stage. Then she was still teaching. She said, this is a great day because how stupid we are to limit the education of all our young people. We have to realize we all go ahead together or we all go down together. And as much as FDR had to juggle a Dixiecrat Congress, he and Eleanor Roosevelt shared a vision of justice. He said in 1940, we will have a liberal democracy or we will return to the dark ages. And that was, although she understood his need to juggle, he never silenced her about what was needed in the United States. And it's been a very long road, and that we are still on that road of the Calabars, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois said, is really astonishing.
And we're still also dealing with an issue of migrant workers. And she read The Grapes of Wrath, and
yes.
Few people know that she also went out into the fields of California to meet with migrant workers.
She met with migrant workers, and she said, you know, she's one of the first people to say there are no illegal people. We are all one. She was very inspired by Wendell Willkie's One World. Everything that happens anywhere affects everybody everywhere. We are all in this together. And I dedicate my book, this book is dedicated to all those activists and agitators who resist tyranny, challenge authority, fight for peace, freedom, and human rights as we continue our journey for one world, no borders, no boundaries, no walls. And that was Eleanor Roosevelt's message and her lifelong quest. It begins in the 1920s when she says we have to all build movements to make change happen. You can't depend on politicians to do anything about that. We have to go door to door, block by block, community by community to make our wants and our needs known. And we have to march and we have to protest. She called it trooping for democracy. And then at the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is really the beacon of hope for people around the world, and the U.S. is still not even considered the Economic and Social Rights Covenant. But Eleanor Roosevelt, when Harry Truman said, do not support Economic and Social Rights Covenant, the Economic and Social Rights part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because that was Soviet-inspired, Eleanor Roosevelt said, no, you can't talk human rights to people who are hungry. And she said, if you want me to do that, I will resign. And he said, no, don't resign. So we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and she compromised on dividing it into two covenants, and still we have to ratify the economic and social rights, which some of us thought Hillary Clinton was going to do. But the bottom line is that was her lifelong quest, human rights, equal dignity, respect, legitimacy, civil rights, human rights for everybody, education, freedom, peace.
We're visiting with Blanche Wieson Cook. She is the New York Times bestselling author of the trilogy on Eleanor Roosevelt. The latest volume is Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962. In 1939, and when she went into the White House as First Lady, I want to know a little bit about, perhaps because of her background with her mother and her grandmother and family in general, how did she juggle that in the White House to be the First Lady, but also to be a mother to her children, and the fact that FDR's infidelities and his relationship with Lucy Mercer?
Well, that's two very big questions.
Yes.
What by the time Eleanor Roosevelt was in the White House, her children are off at school, mostly Groton and Harvard. But Eleanor Roosevelt, people say I don't spend enough time on her children. And one of the things that I used to joke about was I spent about as much time as Eleanor did, which is not enough. But she really worked very hard to support her children. One of the reasons she kept working was her children very often depended on her to bail them out of their problems, which she always, always did. So she's a model for her children and her many grandchildren who right now are continuing Eleanor Roosevelt's legacy in their various works. And how she dealt with FDR's infidelity and the serial affairs. After Lucy Mercer, she treated Missy LaHand as the junior wife with respect and affection. They were friends. But it gave Eleanor Roosevelt the freedom to have her own life. And Eleanor Roosevelt was a serial romantic. There is Lorena Hickok in her life. That's kind of over by about 1936. And then she gets involved with groups of young people, including Joe Lash, who is her, you know, sort of adopted son and biographer. And it was Joe Lash who said, Eleanor Roosevelt is infinite. Many people disagree about whether or not she had an affair with Earl Miller, who is this beautiful state trooper who played the piano the way her father played the piano, who sang, who introduced her to wonderful people she became close to, including Mayoress Tiny Cheney, the dancer. And it was, you know, she shot rifles with Earl Miller. She rode horses with Earl Miller. They took wonderful camping trips together. And if you look at pictures of Earl Miller, I created a category, why not? Because he's a hunk. And we know FDR is off the way his women, and she has her besties.
When the president is considering running again, he asks her if she would, first he asks her about what she thinks, and then he invites her to go to the convention and speak on his behalf. Tell us about that.
Well, that's in 1940.
Yes.
When the delegates were sort of in rebellion, and they didn't want Henry Wallace for vice president. And Eleanor Roosevelt goes. And it's really the first time you see her absolute power with politicians and with the general public. And she gets a standing ovation, and FDR gets what he wants and needs. And he's very grateful. He sends her around the world, really. Whenever he needs to know something, he sends her. She is his eyes and ears, and she is, as some of his friends noted, she is his conscience. But he admires her, and he says, anybody will tell anything to my wife. And it's that trust that he has in her, and she has a great deal of admiration and trust in him.
Tell us about what happened, okay, after the president dies. Harry Truman takes over, and we've heard and read about the famous line where she tells him, is there anything we can do you, or something like
he comes in, and he says, what can I, and she says, the president has died. And Harry Truman said, is there anything I can do for you? And she says, well, is there anything we can do for you? You're the one in trouble now. And one of the very interesting things is that they have a wonderful correspondence where she tutors Harry Truman about how to deal with people like Churchill, for example. And then after she left the White House with 20 trucks of her possessions, 12 years of living in the White House, she tells the waiting reporters in her lobby, the story is over. But the story isn't over because Truman invites her to be the UN representative at the first opening of the UN in London. And Eleanor Roosevelt first hesitates, but her children and her friends say, of course you must go. And she goes reluctantly, but it really is the beginning of a new phase of her life that is truly brilliant and exciting, and results in the passage of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Her diplomacy, her love of people, as Lady Stella Redding said, really triumphs.
As far as her doing everything she did as a first lady, did she kind of set the standard for other first ladies, or has that gone?
Well, you know, she was the only activist first lady. There are Lou Henry Hoover, who was also a scholar and actually wrote with Herbert Hoover many of their, I mean, she was a kind of undercover partner in policy issues. But Eleanor Roosevelt is the only publicly activist first lady. Bess Truman certainly doesn't want to have a column. She doesn't want to have a radio program. She doesn't want to have anything to do. And she doesn't actually live in Washington. Truman is the loneliest president in history. And then other first ladies, Lady Bird, Johnson, who did some public things, the war on, you know, poverty issues and the beautification of her program for beautification, but still not the kind of vigor that, although Lady Bird Johnson was remarkable in so many ways, she too was much more reserved. And then I think Michelle Obama, who, you know, took certain issues on, but again, did not have a broadcast or until her support for Hillary Rodham Clinton. I think Hillary Rodham Clinton came closest to an activist first lady, and then she really, I think, used Eleanor Roosevelt as her model.
At the end, she died a quiet death, and a death that even her funeral, she said she wanted nothing state, private. Some people might say, well, why didn't you write more about her death?
A lot of people have said that, and I'm sorry I didn't write. I mean, there was so much more to write. It was a very painful death of tuberculosis. She was initially misdiagnosed, and she was treated with steroids, which caused her tuberculosis to really destroy her body. And I wanted to deal with her legacy more than her passing.
So, yes, as you mentioned, this is a book, a trilogy, about her life and not about her death.
Right, right.
As far as if people want additional information, Blanche, about the trilogy, about Eleanor Roosevelt, perhaps websites, particular websites, where should they go?
Well, Alida Black at George Washington University has an Eleanor Roosevelt website where Eleanor Roosevelt's My Day columns and many of her other writings are posted. I will have some blogs in the future. I'm not electronically up yet, but I will have some blogs. And then I think the Roosevelt Library is working on putting Eleanor Roosevelt's papers online, and that's going to be very excited, Franklin Delano Roosevelt Library at Hyde Park. I'm hoping one of the things that I'm very proud of is I worked for the State Department Historical Advisory Office in the 1980s after my Eisenhower book came out, which was called The Declassified Eisenhower. And we were working on freedom of information and declassification. And I would get mountains of correspondence before every meeting from my boss, Bill Slaney. And one day I said, look at all this material you send me. Where's Eleanor Roosevelt's human rights file, her State Department file? He said, let's go look for it. And we did. In the National Archives, we found 198 boxes. And I'm hoping that the Foreign Relations of the U.S. series, the State Department series, will now publish many of those documents, which we declassified way back in 1988.
Well, Blanche, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here and share with us your knowledge of Eleanor Roosevelt, and particularly this latest book, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After 1939 to 1962. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We've been visiting with Blanche Wiesen-Cook, the author again of the Eleanor Roosevelt trilogy. The third volume is Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Alisa Cardona. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.